The book of 2 Samuel gives us a good illustration of the various kinds of literature and their purposes that the several anonymous writers and editors wove together in order to reach a coherent story, especially concerning the period of Israel's history when they were ruled by kings. And of course, the overriding reality that God inspired and visibly directed the minds and the hands of these authors is why some matters were only briefly discussed, while others were given more emphasis, more detail. What always mattered more than gory battle accounts and precise chronology were the God principles that were being elucidated and taught. And this unorthodox method that we find in the Hebrew Bible of briefly and of matter-of-factly recording wars and dynasties and the accomplishments of kings and potentates, this was totally unlike that of Israel's neighbors, who tended to glorify, even deify human leaders and to eulogize military victories and expansive sagas of heroism and bravery and strategy and warfare skills. And while only a precious few Hebrews in that era recognized the sure, the steady hand of the God of Israel in these events that guided, that described Israel's progress, and fewer still comprehended the deeper spiritual element of God's pronouncements and his predetermined unfolding of redemptive history, we worshipers of Jehovah, of the God of Israel, of the 21st century, we have the benefit of hindsight. We have the benefit of the coming of the Messiah, and his name is Yeshua, Jesus the Christ, to aid us. This advantage of hindsight gives us a more complete, a more comprehensive view of the amazing divine path, of the many milestones that mark the way, how they all interconnected to bring us to these, the latter days, as we near the finish line of God's redemptive program. So the first six chapters of 2 Samuel that used a great deal of dialogue among Bible characters to chronicle, to explain David's rise to the throne upon Saul's death, chapter 7 paused to impart the reason that the God of Israel was doing what he was doing, especially as it concerned making David great in the eyes of the people and feared and admired by the surrounding nations. But chapter 7 was also future-oriented. It was prophetic. God determined that this was the moment he was going to just lift a corner of that veil, ever so slightly, that lay over his plan of redemption and reveal it to David, since the cornerstone of that plan would involve an unnamed, an unknown descendant of this king. Neither David nor his subjects could have known what we know with certainty. That mysterious descendant was Yeshua of Nazareth, God's anointed one. It's fitting that the issue of the temple is what the lesson of 2 Samuel chapter 7 was built around. Because the point for David in wanting to build that temple was how to ensure God's presence with him at all times. So while God was essentially responding to David's request by explaining he had no need, he had no want for a fancy earthly dwelling place, and that his natural mode was to travel with his people, David was still thinking in terms of building a necessarily immobile stone and cedar wood edifice for the Lord. In fact, and I have little doubt that David didn't get this point, God made it clear that even though he would allow a son of David to build a temple, that God would not be dwelling there, like a bird in a cage or a genie in a bottle. However, his name would dwell there. Thus, in retrospect, we can see all the parameters being laid out for a whole series of realities that would come a long time into the future of David's day. The most important parameters being that God dwells in heaven, not on earth, and that he cannot be housed in a building made by men, but rather he will be constantly present among and with his people. In times far beyond David's time, God will make his presence available not only to priests, not just to royalty, but to all people who trust in him. And they will not have to go to a specific place to visit him, to worship him. But he will travel with them wherever they go, wherever we go. Be with us, be with them, wherever they are. Now, I'm not sure that a modern day believer can comprehend just what a radical notion that was. What the Israelites thought regarding where gods live, how gods interacted with the nations in their charge, was generally the same thoughts that their idol-worshipping neighbors harbored. Whatever David pictured as how God accomplished his plan to always be present with his people on earth is certainly not what we now know to be the case. 2 Corinthians 6:16. What agreement can there be between the temple of God and idols? For we are the temple of the living God. As God said, I will house myself in them, and I will walk among you. I will be their God. They will be my people. So what we see that is that just as the Lord said in 2 Samuel chapter 7, he's determined to be in a tabernacle, a portable dwelling place, if you would. And this is so he can travel with his people and get that concept into their minds. And while the New Testament commonly refers to us, God's worshipers, as his temples, that's just really a reflection of the common speech of those times. More correctly, we are not God's temples. We're his tabernacles. We are temporary traveling tents. But not only that, but because the Lord will house himself in his people, no separation from him is possible. It can't occur. In other words, if the Lord permitted himself to be housed inside of a temple building, then he was, by definition, separated from his people unless they journeyed to that temple. Romans 8:38-39, for I am convinced that neither death nor life, neither angels nor other heavenly rulers, neither what exists nor what is coming, neither powers above or powers below, nor any other created thing will be able to separate us from the love of our God, which comes to us through the Messiah, Yeshua, our Lord. David didn't comprehend all this. He didn't comprehend how it could be that his descendant would rule over God's people, Adullam, forever. Because in its simplest sense, this means that his mysterious descendant would live forever. But David did understand that what God was proposing was beyond anything that a man could imagine, that a human could bring about. And David believed God. My brothers and sisters in Christ, that is all that the Lord is asking. asking of us. He asks us to believe him, to trust him, even though we're just not equipped to grasp all the depth of his promises or to understand how it's even possible for them to come about, even precisely how they're going to be manifested. That's the essence of walking by faith and not by sight. Let's move on to 2 Samuel chapter 8, where the form and the nature of what is written makes this dramatic shift now. So open your Bibles to 2 Samuel chapter 8. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 342. Sometime afterwards, David attacked the Philistines and he subdued them. David took Metegmah out of the hands of the Philistines, and he subdued Moab, making them lie down on the ground. And he measured them with a length of cord. For every two lengths to be put to death, he designated one length to be kept alive. The people of Moab became subjects of David and paid tribute. Now David, on his way to establish his dominion as far as the Euphrates River, also defeated Hadadezer, the son of Rehob, king of Zobah. David captured 1,700 horsemen and 20,000 foot soldiers. He reserved enough horses for 100 chariots and disabled the rest. And when people from Aram, from Damascus, came to the aid of Hadadezer, king of Zobah, David killed 22,000 men of Aram. And then David put garrisons among the people of Aram and Damascus. Aram became subject to David and paid tribute. And Adonai gave victory to David wherever he went. And David took the gold shields from Hadadezer's servants that they were wearing, and he brought them to Jerusalem from Betach and Berotai, cities of Hadadezer. King David took a great quantity of bronze. And when Toi, king of Hamath, heard that David had defeated Hadadezer's entire army, Toi sent Joram, his son, to King David to greet and to congratulate him on fighting and defeating Hadadezer. For Hadadezer had been at war with Toi. Joram brought with him articles of silver, articles of gold, articles of bronze, which King David dedicated to Adonai, along with the silver and the gold that he dedicated from all the nations he conquered: Aram, Moab, the people of Ammon, the Pelishtim, Amalek, and the spoils taken from Hadadezer, son of Rehob, king of Zobah. David gained more fame on returning from killing 18,000 men from Aram in the Salt Valley. David stationed garrisons in Edom. He put garrisons throughout all of Edom, and all the people of Edom became subject to him. Adonai gave victory to David wherever he went. David ruled over all Israel. David administered law and justice for all of his people. Joab, the son of Zeruiah, was commander of the army. Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was his chief advisor. Zadok, the son of Ahitub, and Ahimelech, the son of Eviatar, were his priests. Sariah was his secretary. Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was in charge of the Kriti and the Paliti, serving as the king's bodyguards, and David's sons were Kohanim, were priests. Well, the record of God's promises to establish his forever kingdom through David's lineage in chapter 7 is now followed by an account of the wars that David fought to expand and to establish the earthly geographical borders of his kingdom. And we need to note that this chapter is not in strict chronological order with the other chapters of 2 Samuel, nor are the events depicted in this chapter in perfect order, because that's not the point. The idea was to produce a summary, a brief catalog, if you would, of military victories of David. And the opening phrase in verse 1, sometime afterward, probably ought to be considered as referring to a time not too long after chapter 6 that tells of the arrival of the Ark of the Covenant to the city of David. Now, not surprisingly, The first war was with the Philistines, who had for scores of years tried to lord over Canaan in order to protect their all-important trade routes that crisscrossed that region and connected to their seaports that were on the Mediterranean coast. And we're told that Metegemah was taken out of the hands of the Philistines. Now, this problematic phrase appears differently in practically every Bible version created, but some of that's because of a failure by Bible scholars to connect it to the parallel account that's recorded in 1 Chronicles 18. In 1 Chronicles 18:1, we read, "Sometime afterwards, David attacked the Philistines and subdued them, and David took Gath and its villages out of the hands of the Philistines." Metegemah can literally be translated as the bridal of the mother. This is a figure of speech that in some ways is still common in the Middle East today. Who can forget Saddam Hussein promising America the mother of all wars if our armed forces were to attack? In the Middle Eastern thought, the mother is often seen as the chief or the originator of something. So in Philistia, the city of Gath was seen as the chief city, the mother city. And the other four cities that formed that Pentapolis of the Philistines as the daughter cities of the mother city. The bridal controls the beast. And so in whomever's hand the bridal is held, they have power over the beast. Gath was the most powerful of the five Philistine cities, a sort of capital city, even though the five cities were generally independent of one another. And so the Lord or the King of Gath held some kind of sway over the other four. Now what's being explained here in such typical Oriental fashion is that Gath and its king, who interestingly was still Achish, who had harbored David from the murderous King Saul, was captured by David. And by capturing Gath, the mother city of the Pentapolis, the Philistines were greatly weakened, and their influence over the region was effectively neutered. So while Metegemah is referring to Gath, it's no more an official or alternate formal name for Gath than the Big Apple is an official or alternate formal name for New York City. But it is indicative of that city's importance and status, and acknowledges that it is that nation's overall power center. The next victory is briefly described in verse 2. This victory is over another people. It's called the Moabites. And it's interesting that David ordered such harsh treatment of the Moabite population so that apparently 2/3 of the Moabite soldiers were executed. And the passage says that David used a length of cord to measure the people, the troops of Moab, and for every 2 lengths of it, he killed 2 soldiers, and for every 1 length of it, he allowed that soldier to live. There is no other record of any conquering nation that used that strange method to determine who lived and who died among the enemy. Therefore, I highly suspect that this is just some kind of a figure of speech. There wasn't this actual measuring ceremony. Rather, there was, I'm sure, some summary means of lining up the defeated combatants and killing 2 out of 3 of them. And it was as if someone used a measuring cord to measure out who would die, who would live. Now, what surprises me more than the mass execution is that it involved Moab. Moab had been a friend of sorts to David and to his family in years past. The king of Moab, if you'll recall, had agreed to let David's parents and his family live there, protected, while David was on the run from King Saul. Even more, David's famous ancestor, Ruth, was from Moab. So there was an ancient family connection here. Although it's not recorded, It must have been that Moab seriously offended David, and the repercussions were pretty severe. Or David concluded then that unless Moab was greatly weakened, they just wouldn't be controllable. And the most expedient way to weaken a nation has always been to diminish their military. And verse 3 explains that part of David's aim was to extend Israel's dominion all the way north to the Euphrates River. Now, no doubt this was seen in David's eyes as a given, because it was promised to Abraham in the Torah back in Genesis 15. Genesis 15, 18, that day Adonai made a covenant with Avram. I have given this land to your descendants from the Wadi of Egypt to the great river, the Euphrates River. Thus, David led an expeditionary force to the north and to the east, and he confronted the nations of that region who had no intention of being part of a greater Israel if they could help it. And a fellow named Hadadezer was the general of the army from the nation of Tsova, a nation that was located near Damascus, Syria. And Hadad was the name of the supreme sun god of that culture. So this fellow's name meant Hadad, the sun god, is my help. This army of Hadad had many horses and chariots, and they were all captured by David's forces. But David, who was aware of God's instructions from Deuteronomy 17, kept only sufficient horses to operate 100 chariot teams, and he hobbled the remainder. Deuteronomy 17, 15, and 16. In that event, you must appoint as king the one whom Adonai your God will choose. He must be one of your kinsmen, the king you appoint over you. You are forbidden to appoint a foreigner over you who is not your kinsman. However, he's not to acquire many horses for himself, or have the people return to Egypt to obtain more horses, inasmuch as Adonai told you to never go back that way again. Aram and Tsovah were part of a large coalition that included the nation of Ammon, and apparently they acted to help one another when they were attacked. So next we read that some Arameans came to the aid of Hadad, and they too were slaughtered by David's army. And here we see the time when the area around Damascus, Syria, came under Israel's influence and control, as David didn't merely conquer them, he left substantial garrisons of Israeli troops to secure the region. So from here forward, we're going to see a connection between Syria, sometimes called Aram, sometimes just referred to as Damascus, or in Hebrew, Damasek. And we're going to see that connection between them and Israel continue all throughout biblical times. Much of the time as friends, but other times as enemies. A substantial Jewish community even sprang up there. So we find the Apostle Paul on his way to Damascus, the road to Damascus, to try to expose or arrest some Jesus sympathizers. And verses 7 through 12 explain that David confiscated gold and bronze away from the conquered peoples. He took it back to Jerusalem, and no doubt he stored it away for later use to construct the temple and its furnishings and make all of its ritual implements. And then we find out that he also attacked yet another army, killing 18,000 of its troops. And this gained David an even greater level of fame than he was already enjoying. Verse 13 speaks of his battle with Aram in the Salt Valley. I told you earlier, Aram is another name for Syria. So Aram here, at this point in verse 13, this is a copyist error. The Valley of Salt was an Edom, not Aram. This, of course, comports with the next verse that states that David garrisoned troops in Edom, and that all of Edom became subject to King David. But it also shifts the scene then from the north to the south. And it records how David expanded Israel towards the southeast as well as he did to the northeast. And then the key to all of David's successes ends verse 14. Adonai, actually it says, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, Yehovah, actually gave victory to David wherever he went. The phrase, wherever he went, then brings us full circle. Right back to the point that was made in the previous chapter, 2 Samuel chapter 7. God travels with his people. He's not left behind in a golden box. He's present with David wherever David is, and this is at God's doing, not David's. A temple's not needed. In fact, no ritual article of furniture is needed for Jehovah's presence. Further, God's not limited by national boundaries. All people of all known cultures in that era believed as an unassailable fact that their God's sphere of authority didn't go any further than their own national boundaries, but that they could transport that God with them to foreign conflicts, and hopefully that God could do them some good, like maybe intimidating that enemy. And then verse 15 explains a couple of important premises about David's reign. First, this is a big one. He ruled over, it says, all Israel. The term all Israel is one we've discussed on a number of occasions because except for brief periods of time, Israel was always divided into two main camps, Judah and Israel, or as it was called a few years after King Solomon's death, Judah and Ephraim. So while on the surface, the term all Israel might seem to the average Bible student not all that important. In fact, it's a critical piece of information that the ancient Hebrews would have instantly grabbed hold of. See, this had not been so, that a king ruled over all the tribes of Israel that now formed a single nation, like David was doing. This hadn't occurred since the days of Joshua. Sadly, although David's son Solomon would inherit this arrangement and even improve upon it to a degree, within a matter of 3 or 4 years after Solomon's death, Israel would fall into civil war, and it would dissolve right back into its age-old tribal coalitions that primarily consisted of the 10 of them to the north, which is now called Ephraim, and the 2 to the south, that's now called Judah. And the second important piece of information in verse 15 is that David ruled in what the complete Jewish Bible and other versions translate as law and justice. That's a bad translation. The original Hebrew is mishpat tzedekah, and it ought to be translated as justice and righteousness. Are probably most literally as righteous judgment. Here is the appearance of a pattern that was called for in the Torah. And we're going to encounter several places in David's story where the narrator will point out an action of David that is actually a Torah commandment or it's a pattern. Deuteronomy 16, 18 through 20. You are to appoint judges and officers for all your gates in the cities Adonai your God is giving you, tribe by tribe, and they are to judge the people with righteous judgment. Mishpat Tzedekah. You are not to distort justice or show favoritism. You are not to accept a bribe, because a gift blinds the eyes of the wise. It twists the words of even the upright. Justice, only justice, you must pursue it, so that you will live and inherit the land Adonai your God is giving to you. So here in Deuteronomy, we see that phrase, righteous judgment, Mishpat Tzedekah, and it is in the form of a commandment that Israel's civil authorities are to rule by adhering to this underlying premise. Deuteronomy 16 even went so far as to define righteous judgment by saying there ought to be no favoritism, no distortion of justice, no accepting a bribe to help predetermine an outcome. And this is what is being ascribed now to David's rule. And notice also the final words of verse 15 that say that David applied this Mishpat Tzedekah to all the people. This is not referring to a social economic class, but rather to the ongoing reality that David didn't show partiality to his own coalition, his own tribal coalition of Judah, over King Saul's old tribal coalition of all the northern tribes. And then this chapter ends by listing David's senior cabinet members. Joab. This was the fellow who had several years earlier murdered Abner. He was the supreme military commander of the northern tribal coalition, and thus seemed on the verge. Looked like Joab was going to be tossed aside by David, but he's now apparently survived. He's even cemented his position as David's right-hand man and general of the military. A fellow named Jehoshaphat is sometimes called David's chief advisor, but that's misleading. He was David's zakar, his recorder, maybe his scribe. He was charged with recording the official history of David's administration, including all the battle details and the pacts and the treaties that were made with other nations, family genealogy. And to a degree, he was probably, you could consider him as David's royal biographer. Verse 17 throws out a tantalizing tidbit. It's so easy to overlook, as it does so with no fanfare. It is that Zadok became a chief priest, or better, high priest, but that he shared that duty with Abiathar. That's right, David had two high priests. This was purely a political accommodation because it completely set aside the law of God on this matter. Abiathar was seen as the legitimate high priest by the northern tribes. But it wasn't seen so by the south. So David appointed Zadok. This satisfied the people of Judah. Now in reality, Abiathar was not a God-appointed high priest because he came from the wrong line. He came from the line of Ithamar. The high priest was to come from the line of Eleazar. But since the time of Eli, Samuel's mentor, the high priest had come from the line of Ithamar, and thus this was the line of high priests that existed under King Saul. Zadok, on the other hand, came from the proper God-ordained line of Eleazar. After Solomon took over from his father David, he deposed Abiathar. And so Israel finally only had one high priest like they should have, the one that came from the correct lineage, and that high priest was Zadok. Well, the final verse is a little bit cryptic. It's a little bit difficult to understand what it's trying to communicate. First, a man named Benaiah is said to have charge over the Keriti and the Peliti. And some ancient manuscripts add that these were David's bodyguards. Now, assuming this is correct, then what we have here are two groups of foreigners who were hired as mercenaries, and they were used to protect David at his palace. A personal bodyguard was typical for all kings. And it was also typical, actually, to use foreign mercenaries rather than the local nationality. The reason was that foreigners had no real axe to grind about who was king. They just wanted the money. But there was always disagreements, jealousies among the local tribes and the clans who felt that perhaps one of their own should have had the right to power. So to use guards taken from among them presented more of an opportunity for a coup attempt. But we also see that essentially David divided the duty of the civilian police force, David's bodyguard, away from the military, and he put them under entirely separate commanders. In a later chapter, we're going to find out that this Benaiah will eventually supplant Joab, as Israel's military commander. King Solomon's going to make that change. Now, the second piece of difficult information is that it seems to say that David's sons were given the job of priests. Considering that David saw it as no problem to appoint two high priests, one has to wonder if he just felt free to assign as common priests anybody he chose. Some rabbis say here that the Hebrew word kohanim does not mean priests, it just means ministers or rulers, which frankly has no other comparable use in the remainder of the Bible, not before, not after. So I have no doubt this is not correct. Other rabbis admit we have to take this at face value and accept that for some unknown reason, David actually made his own sons priests. Now, I've said it in earlier lessons, and I'm sure I'm going to say it again numerous times. Israel was woefully ignorant of the law of Moses and generally merely followed man-made customs, man-made traditions, and they did what seemed right in their own eyes. That David would think that he could choose not only to maintain two high priests, but also to appoint his own sons as priests, who were obviously Judahites and not Levites, is just another indication of the willful ignorance of Torah that sent Israel into a long death spiral that finally ended in disgrace and exile from their land inheritance. With that particular thought in mind, we're going to exit chapter 8 and move on to chapter 9. But before we do, and this is going to happen next time, I want to set the stage by making a paraphrase, adding a bit of a comment that was made by a marvelous Jewish Christian scholar and writer from the 19th century, a fellow by the name of Alfred Edersheim. In his wonderful work entitled Bible History of the Old Testament, he makes a general observance about biblical characters, most of them referred to as biblical heroes. And it's this. There is a common, if not an alarming, peculiarity about even the most prominent and the highly praised Bible personalities. And it presents us with a rather humbling personal lesson if we'll only pay attention to it and allow it to sink very deeply into our hearts. As we watch these especially revered Bible characters appear in the holy texts, and then as we see them progress, they seem at times to be far beyond our reach in their purity of thoughts and their courage and perfection of action. It seems as though perhaps the evil inclinations and our propensity to give in to temptations and impulses that derails us mere mortals, and at times sends us spiraling into guilt and to defeat, didn't even exist in them at all. And I say that this is not fair. It's almost as that their awesome lives of walking in faith and courage is no example for us at all, because they're so near perfect in their selfless devotion to God and to His will that we can't envision ourselves ever approaching such a thing. But then suddenly, without warning, these Bible heroes fall. A dark shadow passes over them that ironically illuminates a hidden side of their character that we never saw coming. One that seems incongruous with what we have otherwise seen them accomplish. On the one hand, this demonstrates to us the terrible and often unseemly struggles that actually went on inside of these great Bible heroes, even as they went about the divine task assigned to them by the Lord. And on the other hand, we are witness to how God's divine grace alone had given them the victory over those dark inner struggles, many of which we can easily imagine, but were not necessarily detailed for us. They maybe weren't even written down. And what's even more alarming is that we often find these great heroes of faith succumbing to that dark shadow of flawed character just as they're reaching the spiritual climax of their lives. That moment's arrived. After they've accomplished these great feats, after they've witnessed divine miracles, they've experienced deliverance in ways that have become legendary, and they're recounted countless times in sermons and Sunday school lessons, and after they've seemingly won out against fear and rebellion, and they are at the pinnacle of faith, that's when they fall. That's when the decline happens. We saw this dilemma appear with Moses and Aaron. We watched Abraham turn his own wife over to Pharaoh. We've already had some glimpses of it, and soon we're going to witness it at an even greater level with David. Later on with Elijah. What we need to take from this, God doesn't pick great men and women to do his work on earth. God picks ordinary men and women to use for great things that he's gonna do. The same flaws that we all fight in our lives were present in those admirable Bible characters that we read about. We don't need to be intimidated by these Bible heroes. We don't have to put them on pedestals as untouchable. They merely did the one thing that many of us have not. They said yes when the Lord called. They didn't even know what that yes might entail. They didn't know what it would lead to, because that is the number one condition for serving him. Yes, without knowing what. But for those who've answered the Lord's call and have participated in things of merit for the kingdom that others stand back, admire, or pray that they would be called to do, I want to forewarn you. Being at the pinnacle of faith and accomplishment often means that that fall to that valley floor is a lot longer and a lot more jarring when you get there. So if we have answered the call, if we have been led to great victories, we not only have to carefully maintain our humility before God, we need to maintain ourselves in his kindness in the same way as when it was that we started to ascend to that mountaintop. By trusting in his sufficiency and not in our own knowledge, not on our own abilities, by recognizing that we are all human. Failures and defeats are going to be part of our lives. And all the more so if we think that we have finally reached some point of nearness to God that makes us almost immune. And in the coming chapters, when we watch David of all people, succumb to his own humanness, to his own agendas, often woven together with God's, for cover. We need to do so with understanding, and we need to do it with sorrow as opposed to surprise, to condemnation. After all, every single one of the greatest Bible heroes were mere humans, as much in need of God's constant favor and grace and forgiveness as we all are.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning, products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seed of Abraham Fellowship.